This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research. Although Lyman Page once spent springtime in Antarctica and 2 years sailing the Atlantic, his greatest adventure is no less than mapping the universe. As a key member of the WMAP, Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe mission, Page helped measure the cosmic microwave background, a backdrop of cosmic static visible everywhere in the sky and thought by physicists to be the afterglow of the Big Bang. The data he and his team gathered with WMAP shed new light on the shape, composition, evolution, and age of the universe, a feat that led Science magazine to label the mission the 2003 Breakthrough of the Year. Page was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2006. He serves as the Henry DeWolf Smythe Professor of Physics at Princeton University. He was interviewed by Gisela Tellis in 2008.
So I grew up on pretty much on both sides of the country. We moved around a lot. I was born in San Francisco, and then we moved to Palo Alto, and then to Virginia, and then New Hampshire, and then Palo Alto back again, and then up to Maine, where I was through junior high school and high school. You know, I was just a normal guy. I liked math. I always liked math, so that was just an interest, but I wasn't a superstar or anything like that. I just liked doing it. You know, I built tree forts. We bought with my dad. We bought a sailboat when I was in third grade and worked on that some. Like to hike. I started a bike shop when I was young. So I think a lot of just building and hiking and playing and that sort of thing.
When did you become interested in science?
I really can almost pinpoint it to the month. It was in the first semester of college, and I went to college thinking I'd be like an English philosophy major.
Why?
I think because of the questions of why are we here? What are we all about? And just sort of those big questions, and I thought at the time that philosophy was a way to get to them and understand them. And in fact, my father was an English major, so he said, "No, just read great literature, and you'll understand much more." So that was probably the English side of the philosophy versus English. And then I'd had some physics before, but I really didn't get anything out of it in high school. And I had this physics class from Elroy Lacaze, and it was one of those things where I loved it, and it resonated. And I then started to go to the library and look for physics books, things like that. What really captivated me was I was just up in the library trying to understand what the field was like. And I was just strolling down the aisles looking for physics books, and I saw this book called Gravitation by Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler, and I just pulled it down. It was just it was almost random. I'd heard about general relativity as this incredible subject, so I was hunting around that area, and I saw this book, and I just started thumbing through it, and I just thought, wow, this is neat. This is what I want to study. And so Bowdoin was flexible enough for the event to go and arrange my schedule so I could make an independent class studying this book. And so that's how I really got drawn in through the more astro end of it, and just through to thinking about the skies. Right, was through trying to understand general relativity and its implications.
Did you think then that you wanted to continue and be a physicist?
Yes. But I didn't know how. I really didn't have a sense for what it meant. And, you know, at times I thought I'd want to be an astronomer sitting in an observatory somewhere. And I had no idea how it worked. And other times I just wanted to do lab physics. But I also didn't understand, certainly as our seniors do today, that what it means to go to graduate school and what it's like. So I applied to go to graduate school. I remember I took the GREs, not having any idea of what they'd be like. And I didn't do that well, so I forget where I got into graduate school. But it wasn't. I just said, no, I don't want to go there. I don't know what I'll do. And at the same time, actually a little prior to that, I'd seen this advertisement on our bulletin board to run cosmic ray stations in the Antarctic. And so I thought, wow, that might be fun. So I applied to that as well, and that did work out. So I knew I loved physics, and I wanted to keep after it. But I probably just wasn't mentally prepared to go on, and or even really knew what it meant. And this opportunity came up, and it was somehow satisfied some adventurous part of the spirit, and did that after I graduated. It was certainly a great time in my life because it was, it's just a time to figure out what's important to you, what you care about, what are you after, all those sort of, those questions you ask when, I guess, you go through that phase or one of the many times you may go through that phase. But so I went down the station, was in McMurdo Sound, which is about 700 or so miles from the pole. And it was a mile outside the Navy base. So there were 5 civilians and about 60 Navy personnel there. And so I lived a mile outside the base and ran the station looking for these cosmic rays from the sky. I read the Feynman lecture series and, War and Peace, Moby Dick, all those long ones that you maybe not have time to read when you're supposed to read them in school, in college. I remember the Feynman lecture series. I remember because it was it was a new way for me of thinking about physics. It's just all of a sudden, it was really going back to zero, like your first physics class, and reading it again, and it just the way he thought it was. You could learn all this physics one way, and then you can go back and come see it again in this new way, and so that was a real eye-opener, is just how to think more deeply, how to approach different problems. So I did lots of physics problems. And I think it ended up, I remember when I left, you just have this, at least I had this just feeling of, I don't want to say innocence, but sort of clarity of thought of how that you're comfortable with yourself, right, and what you want, and what's important. Do you want to go to Wall Street or try to go to Wall Street, or do you want to work for a company, or what do you want to do, everything from how to interact with people to sort of some path you want to take. And since you're so isolated there, it comes out, right? And there's enough time to think about those sort of things that you feel pretty comfortable with it in the end. It was great. So that's the more intellectual side. The physical side, it is stunningly beautiful. And the sights are sights that just crystallize in your mind and don't leave, right? This is near the height of the aurora. And they were so grand or so violent that the dogs at the New Zealand base, which is again another mile away from me, would howl at them. They'd be so bright they compare to the moon, and they were active, and they'd be up for nights. That was just beautiful. And to see these sights and see just stars like you'd never see stars anywhere else. The galaxy was bright, when the aurora went out. It was beautiful like that. my other love and something I'd just done all through even college and high school was sailing. So I'd saved up a bunch of money in the Antarctic, right, because they don't pay you that much, but you don't have anything to spend it on. So I had a bunch of money in the bank. And so I went to, long and short, I went and I bought an old wooden sailboat. And then up in Maine, up in Spruce Head, Maine. And so I was just going to sail. I don't know what I had my sights on, but I definitely wanted to get through the Panama Canal. And anyway, so I bought this old sailboat, and you could see it was out of the water. It was a mess. I paid way too much for it. Spent all my money buying it instead of, and I should have saved more for fixing it. But you could see through every plank, and what was great was the boatyard there, where they were just it was a boatyard full of old Mainers, old Maine fishermen, and it was the only sort of luxury boat there at the time, and we just I went up and started and tried to learn more about fixing boats. And my friend, a lifelong friend from high school, came up and helped me. He was older than I was, but he came up to help me, and we wanted to, we had to replace the keel bolts, because if we put it in the water, the keel would have fallen off, right? This is a four-ton piece of iron that makes it sit upright. Right? It's a 37-foot Crocker catch. And so we knew we had to replace the keel bolts because they were rotted out. And we took an old bandsaw blade and just cut the keel off. And it's like cutting, it's like heart surgery on a boat, right? And these guys from the boatyard just, they couldn't believe it. And not that they wouldn't have done it, but that there was me, this kid, who had too much money, enough to buy a boat, was doing this. They loved it. They came out with a big case of beer and sat down and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. They called all their friends. They set me up with this guy to make new keel bolts up the coast in Maine. They set me up with a machine shop so I could thread the new keel bolts. They got their old supply of wood to make a little shiv that goes in there. And they got their old caulker, Ralph, who caulked, dozens of boats to teach me how to caulk, or teach a group of us by that time. So I had friends coming up how to caulk. And so we over the summer, we fixed up this boat, and then sailed and worked on the boat for the next 2.5 years, and never made it through the Panama Canal. And so we sailed down with various friends down through through the islands, and just working from port to port. Working, I worked as a carpenter. I mean, I'd just done carpentry my whole life, so I worked as a carpenter and a rigger. And a painter, and just we'd land, we'd get jobs, hustle jobs, and then and finally we were going to make it through the canal. And we set off with my friend, another college friend, Jed West, and we ran into this storm, probably not really bad, but moderately bad, about just about 80 miles north of the Venezuelan-Colombian border. This funny wave hit us, and it snapped the jib around. And first our rudder broke, and then so we were stealing by the sails, and then we had this funny wave, and it snapped the jib around. The jib snapped in half, so then we couldn't steer by the sails anymore. And so then we had to do what's called hove to. You come into the wind and sail into the wind, and that was sort of it. We knew we weren't going to make Panama, so we ended up in Jamaica. And it was that night when we turned around that it was... Yep, I want to sail to Boston and apply to graduate school. At that time, Ray had been he'd been working in the gravitational wave detectors, so LIGO, what was now become LIGO. And he was also working on the microwave background measurements, which is what I do now. And he was the chair of the COBE Science Working Group. And so I started working for Ray in these... weekends and evenings. And the project he gave me was to measure the noise properties of field effect transistors when they were cooled to see how much better they got, to see what they were like. And it involved, well, thinking about noise, for one, electronic noise, which continue to do to this day, and working with cryogenics, which still continue to do. And, of course, nothing went right. And eventually worked, but, you know, for weeks or months, you know, the doer would leak, I wouldn't wire things correctly, all sorts of things like that, you know, real-world problems. But anyway, just chipped away at it and started to get to know the place. And then applied for graduate school, a bunch of places, including MIT. Still, just when I think back on it, still, even after being there, how naive I was about the whole process. And Ray would just sort of, he just laughed at me at how out of it. You know, he said, "Do you want me to write your letter of recommendation?" And remember, I told him, "Well, I just don't think you know me well enough." And he said, he sort of rolled his eyes. I said, "Okay, so you want me to influence it at a higher level?" I just, anyway, so it was sort of like that. We got along. It was fun. And so I applied to graduate school and continued to work as a carpenter.
Did he write you a letter of recommendation?
He did whatever he did and got me into graduate school. He basically hauled me off the street and gave me a job. And I continued working on this project. And then after 6 months or so, he was figuring out what he wanted to do. And he said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I was sort of completely at his mercy is the wrong word. But, you know, I would have done whatever he told me to do. And then I don't think I even answered. And I just remember this picture. He used to smoke this pipe, you know, all these corn cob pipes. He sort of swirled it around his teeth and he pulled his pipe out and he said, "Work with Meyer." To put it in context of what was going on at the time, so this past year's Nobel Prize was awarded to George Smoot and John Mather, right, for the COBE satellite. And so this was, many in the field and around the country knew the potential of this radiation to change the way we understood the universe. And it was in the air, but no signal had been measured. And what this radiation is, the temperature of the sky, if you will, the temperature of the universe, if you will, had been measured. That was discovered by Penzias and Wilson. But the field had evolved to the point where, well, not only did we really need to know the temperature much better, which the COBE satellite told us, but there should be these tiny variations in the temperature of the sky. So it means that you look in one direction and it would be, you know, 2.725 degrees above absolute zero. And you'd look in another direction and it would be 2.7252 degrees above absolute zero. And that's called the anisotropy, because it's the change, the difference in temperature as you look across the sky, different places in the sky. And it was understood that these fluctuations, these tiny fluctuations, should be there, but they hadn't been measured. And the reason that we knew they should be there is because if we look up in the skies now, there are galaxies and clusters of galaxies, and the sky's full of objects, right? You can identify and name and look at in telescopes. And those had to form in gravitational valleys, right? Mass had to come together to make those. And now the early universe was very smooth, right? And these objects didn't exist then. And there was also this light from the early universe. So the thought was always that that from somewhere came these gravitational potential wells, these valleys, and the mass that was around from the Big Bang fell into them. And that this radiation should also have fallen into them. And what this radiation would do, these fluctuations, these very spatial variations in the radiation would tell us, if you will, what we now loosely, popularly call the baby picture, but really the picture of the initial conditions of the early universe. It's like a fossil of the early universe in light. And so this is what we were after. How did the universe come to be the way it is? And I think those were, at least from, the experimentalist point of view, that was pretty much what drove us. We knew it had to be there. We had no idea what it would be like. So my thesis with Steve was to build an experiment to go and measure these fluctuations. At the same time, the COBE satellite was up measuring them. So COBE discovered them, and then it turns out the map we made from the data in my thesis, the fluctuations were also in there. So when we cross-correlated with the COBE satellite, we saw a huge signal. But without the cross-correlation, we saw a signal, but we couldn't identify its origin. So that was very exciting. And then discovery of the anisotropy in the microwave background just took off after that. Once the signal was there, it was, what is it like at other angular scales? Are we really sure of its frequency spectrum? And there are many things we didn't know. It's just a sort of a new field was born, and we didn't know how the galaxy would contribute, how bad it would be, what we could tell. And then a lot of, more and more people got excited about it. And what became clear pretty early on was that if you could, in this sort of bootstrapping approach, if you could identify the model, a class of models that the universe followed, that you could extract these parameters of the universe from looking at this radiation. You could tell the curvature of space. You could tell the age of the universe. You could tell if it was the expansion rate. Tell the number. Find the number of atoms in the universe. Find the number of this stuff called dark matter, and probe this crazy element called dark energy. And so it the potential just grew, and now, what's the state now is we have full sky maps that are much finer angular resolution than the COBE satellite, and much more sensitive. And from this radiation, we've done things like we're able to give the age of the universe to what we now it's 13.7 billion years, plus or minus a little under 200 million. So we know the age of the universe to within the age the dinosaurs roamed the Earth. And it's all happened since I was a graduate student. So it's been fantastic. It's been it's a dream. And all of us in the field are like this, right? It's sort of we're in the pinch me phase of how could we have been so lucky to come along at this time when the techniques had evolved to the point where we could measure it, and nature was so kind as to not have thrown a monkey wrench into the program. One obstacle, which in fact in some ways might be psychological, was my thesis flight. This is an instrument that I'd worked on. I guess it had been about 5 years at that time, and I worked weekends, just every day, just plugging away at this thing. And it went up on this balloon payload, and this was for an all-night flight, a 12-hour flight where I was going to get my thesis data and write it up and et cetera. And as soon as it reached altitude, the balloon burst, and my thesis came crashing down. So it ended up in the story is, there are many elements to the story, but the long and the short is my thesis ended up upside down in a cornfield with corn husks rammed down the throat of it. So that was a bit of a setback. And we got enough data, actually, that it was sensitive enough that even with those 7 minutes of data, we set the best limit on the level of fluctuations at that time. And we found new things about interstellar dust and the like. But so that was probably made writing my thesis much easier because I only had 7 minutes of data to analyze. But anyway, so that was a bit of a setback because then we had to bring it back and then rebuild it and then fly it again. But, you know, I mean, experimental physics is anyone who does it has that. Things go awry, you make bad measurements, something breaks, you're not careful enough, something like that. So those are setbacks, you know, you just deal with them. So psychologically, it's mostly, well, I've just been really very fortunate, just, you know, been helped out at many stages by a lot of people. I've had a charmed life.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.